You're watching Notepad. I'm your host, Ibrahim Sani. The government is launching or has launched the National Hydrogen Technology and Economy Roadmap. It's basically detailing out the requirements of hydrogen as an energy source, not just for the country, but for ASEAN as well. And there's plenty to talk about, not just about hydrogen, but energy itself. We know that power generation is going to be a big issue for the years to come. But also distribution. We have to relook at how we can improve our infrastructure, bring better power lines to neighborhoods and the likes, and of course, how the grid is going to work moving forward. There's a lot that needs to be debated and discussed. So therefore, it's my privilege to actually have the CEO of Nano Malaysia. How are you, Dr. Rizal?
I'm good. Thank you for having us.
Of course, Nano Malaysia is part of MoSTI, or the Ministry of Science and Technology. But for those that have never heard of this before, could you please tell us a little bit more about Nano Malaysia and then about the National Hydrogen Technology and Economy Roadmap?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Ibrahim. I mean, a pleasure indeed to be here. I mean, to start with, to set the context early with regards to the mandate that has been given to Nano Malaysia by the heart. So Nano Malaysia itself is a company limited by guarantee. We were incorporated in 2011, so 10 years has passed. We actually celebrated our 10-year anniversary 1st of August this year. So with a bit of fanfare, but with the background of the pandemic, I think everything is relatively a bit muted in that sense. But nonetheless, there's a lot of stuff that we can showcase in terms of achievements. Our primary goal is to look into the development and commercialization of relevant nanotechnology that is applicable and deployable into the market. So it's always with the end in mind as such, working with universities, industries, and even with the associations, I mean, to name a few. In the context of the hydrogen roadmap, why we are involved? Because hydrogen itself is, you know, it's a probably like the most abundant element in the known universe. And hydrogen is the lightest known element. So it tends to be in a nanoscale. So being a subject matter expert in terms of atoms and molecules, I think the policymakers recognize our expertise in this particular domain and has duly appointed us to lead this study in terms of exacting, realizing the potential hydrogen economy for the country, with a lot of technological elements to it to ensure that we are able to sustain the economic growth supported by what we call the hydrogen economy as a way forward. It's a future engine of growth for the country to escape or to recover ourselves from the setbacks and slowdown of the economy due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Pardon my ignorance, but are we talking about renewable energy here or it's back to fossil fuel?
Yes, that is partially yes. I mean, hydrogen will eventually supplant fossil fuel at some point. If you were to take the context of the global market space, the International Renewable Energy Agency, IRENA in short, they have put a global aim with the concerted inputs from the developed nations, talking about the European Union, even countries like Australia, Japan, and the US, or even in the UK as well. There is a target of to drive down the cost of hydrogen where it can reach a certain parity level compared to fossil fuel. So the main aim is to decarbonize the global economy, decarbonize the energy sector specifically to ensure a greener future, more sustainable future for the whole world, in short. So that translates into a number of clarion call by a number of countries which have launched their respective hydrogen initiative, policies, strategies, roadmaps, so on and so forth, at the government level and even at the corporate level as such. So now it's real. 20 years ago, that when we talk about hydrogen economy, which started anyway 2 decades ago, it was serious back then, but somehow the drive towards this renewable energy was not as intense and great as what we see now. Okay, even the big oil and gas companies are now pivoting away into hydrogen or even some solar projects.
Because hydrogen energy has been touted to be the next generation of energy to fuel cars, to power homes, to bring power to offices and the likes, There are debates whether or not this is actually even worse off than fossil fuel. To these kind of comments, how do you address the worries of the folks right now in saying that this is worse or better off than fossil fuel of today?
Okay, Abel, before we go into the detailed discussion with regards to which is best or which is worse or whatnot, the fundamental principle of why hydrogen is even considered is based on science. Okay, for the same kilogram or weight or mass, hydrogen offers 3 times more energy density compared to fossil fuel. Okay, there you go. That's the unique value proposition for people to start to think, oh yeah, 3 times more. Great. But the runaway or the headway towards hydrogen being fairly established in Malaysia or even other countries, okay, people would say hydrogen would be, it's expensive now to produce hydrogen. Gray hydrogen itself, maybe around $1 per kilogram. Green hydrogen, which is what everyone is aiming for. We're talking about green to green. Right? The process to produce hydrogen is green and the hydrogen itself is green. That is still far from what fossil fuel can offer. But nonetheless, because of the more energy density per kilogram of hydrogen, in order for hydrogen to be truly attractive and hit that the so-called inflection point, where economies around the world say, yes, I think we are going to hydrogen, is when the price or the cost to produce hydrogen is 3 times more than fossil fuel. Because you hit that parity because it offers 3 times more energy density. That is where the techno-economic analysis comes to play, where countries like even the US, Japan, South Korea, Malaysia also falling into it, on top of Australia and the European Union. That's the point where the floodgates will be open because we had started to hit that so-called cost parity.
Okay, because the 2021 United Nations COP conference or climate change conference is going to take place at the end of this month, and because of the hypersensitivity or alertness of people on climate change and renewables energy, and not just renewables energy, but any form of energy usage and utilization right now is actually the main topic. Do you feel that this conversation needs to be given a greater importance? How it's going to be rolled out? What are the laws that need to be changed, for instance? What are the implications on the consumer? What would be some of the 2 or 3 things that you feel that all of us need to really think about moving forward when it comes to this roadmap that you guys have been tasked to coordinate with all the stakeholders right now?
Yeah, because I believe the conversation already started. I mean, globally, regionally, and even nationally as such. In fact, that the Economic Planning Unit, the government as a whole, is coming out with a new energy policy. I think it's out in the public domain, but yet to be disclosed in its full glorious form, has indicated a shift, a significant shift towards energy efficiency. And even there is a dedication in terms of this discussion on hydrogen itself. And various conversations have taken place in Malaysia, high level, the ministers, even the captains of GLCs, people like the Tenaga Nasional, Petronas, they have mentioned about that managing that transition into renewables, particularly hydrogen. It's not about whether you want to do it or not, it's about how you manage that transition curve. So it's a matter of the how and the when. So because the eventuality is clear. So the interest is very, very solid in the country. We see, we observe Sarawak government has invested a significant amount of money in terms of creating that catalytical initiative in Sarawak to convert the Bakun electricity into hydrogen storage and to pilot, deploy a number of hydrogen-based fleet cars and vehicles. So that is it's a pathfinder which we duly respect. And Petronas have, I think they have established a division called Petronas Hydrogen, and Tenaga Nasional have incorporated hydrogen as part of their roadmap moving forward. So it's real. That before we started the roadmap, the movements have already started. So the concept or the philosophy of the roadmap is to consolidate all these disparate initiative so that we are able to achieve the same national goals. Otherwise, we'll be so fragmented, shooting all over the place. We want to look at, are we focusing on developing a domestic hydrogen-consuming ecosystem, with all those components in place to ensure that people like you and me at the riot level, wearing the riot hat, are able to also benefit the shift into hydrogen. And also at the same time, for the immediate benefits of the country economically, we are addressing the needs of other countries as well because of the more matured hydrogen economy, countries like South Korea and Japan, where their version of hydrogen economy is underpinned by a user-centric model, i.e. they don't produce hydrogen. They just consume into the ecosystem for the obvious benefits.
Drilling into the details, Sarawak hydrogen is of course being mainly used in petrochemical and semiconductor industries. What kind of lessons do you think we can draw from that and apply it to the rest of the country?
Yeah, we have to be very careful because Sarawak has that Bakun advantage. Bakun in itself have been categorically defined as green. So inherently, the source of energy to produce hydrogen from the Bakun Dam is green. So therefore, the hydrogen they produce and store for the industrial application is green. So Sarawak has that unique advantage. But nonetheless, having said, as you rightly mentioned, the industrial application in terms of the petrochemical industry, going into electronics, but they decided to foray into something a lot more disruptive, which is in the transportation sector, automotive sector, which I think they have bought a fleet of hydrogen-based fuel cell vehicle to pilot test it, to understand the acceptability level of the users in the state to look at what will be the next steps and also to establish their version of a technological roadmap to ensure that whatever that they're doing now at this initial phase is able to be translated into a much more inclusive deployment of hydrogen, i.e. The rural folks, the rural areas as such. And looking at that, what they are doing now, translated to Semenanjung, we need to recontextualize. Semenanjung, Malaysia has a different, how do I say, advantages. We have primarily the likes of the GLC headquartered here, Petronas, Tenaga, and they have their respective activities, of which Tenaga represents a user concept. They can potentially use hydrogen to burn and to generate electricity for everyone's consumption. Whereas Petronas has the potential of to produce hydrogen, per se, as a byproduct from their existing oil and gas activities. We call it green hydrogen as such because the conversion of what they do as a byproduct releases CO2 in the environment. But they have in their game plan to capture those carbon emitted in the atmosphere. So therefore, the hydrogen becomes blue. But we call it hydrogen produced using carbon capture utilization system and storage. But from the user perspective, once all of those so-called energy component is translated into the relevant processes, we see as an end product, electricity. For you and me, we see the end product, which is electricity given to us. The devices that we use, our mobile phones being charged, even with the possible advent of an EV industry in Malaysia, we will get that so-called cleaner electricity so that we are able to move towards what the government, I think, has announced in terms of the decarbonization of our own economy to reach carbon neutrality by a certain year.
Yeah. The decarbonization of our economy has been the big topic of some of my guests. One of them is Anand Padmakantan of Maybank KE. He was basically talking about the lack of direction when it comes to the government in relation to not just EV, but renewables energy. Do you feel that this roadmap is addressing that kind of concerns raised by folks like him? Do you feel that the whole National Hydrogen Blueprint is able to coalesce with all these different groups, I use your word, disparate groups, to put them on the same table and say, look, if there's anything lacking, point this out, this should be in the roadmap?
Yeah. I'm responding to that. Yes, it's a big resounding yes. We have put in place a certain philosophy in crafting out and drafting out our roadmap. So we have a series of what we call the focus group discussion, FGD, and we get our roadmap to be as inclusive and as comprehensive as ever. And the fact that we recognize the pre-existing efforts by Sarawak and understanding the potential of Petronas and Tenaga, even other GLCs. So we talked to Sime Darby, we talked to UMW, and we had a serious discussion even with the university folks, the Malaysian Association of Hydrogen Energy, even Sabah as well, understanding the potential of using this ocean thermal energy to convert to hydrogen. So it is quite comprehensive, because the whole idea is to ensure that no one is being left out in terms of drafting this. And the roadmap is also crafted that it will refer or make references to pre-existing renewable energy or green tech initiative undertaken by various agencies and various ministries, because we want to see how we can plug this hydrogen initiative into all those programs and projects. I'll give you an example. There are pockets of initiative with regards to biomass, and we saw an opportunity of which hydrogen can potentially be produced in a large scale using biomass. So we're talking about the biomass policy or roadmap or strategy can be interlinked with what we aspire under the hydrogen economy and technology roadmap. So that is the approach that we have taken. Inclusive, comprehensive. And some of the guys would say, but I produce small hydrogen technology for personal consumption. Great. We also include those concept of the many of smalls, meaning that if you can produce hydrogen for your own personal consumption or local area, it's great. We're looking also into the concept of decentralization of energy production and energy utilization. So from the very big, the big boys and girls such as Sarawak Energy, Petronas Tenaga, so on and so forth. So we also cater under the roadmap, accommodate all these innovators that can put in place hydrogen production utilizing in the local area. So that's the philosophy.
Dr. Rizal, as I prefaced earlier on in the show, power generation is already a problem that we need to navigate and solve. And as you pointed out very recently just now, from the big players all the way to the small players, power generation is going to be key, top of mind. But there is also this issue of distribution. Neighborhoods right now are being equipped with, I don't know, a 50-year-old technology from transformers, power lines, grid lines, high power cables, medium power cable, and so on. And we all know that, while this is working fine today, it's not nearly enough in the future. What's the story then when it comes to distribution? Is it going to be part of this roadmap?
Yes. Our discussion with TMB was exactly like that, because we need to understand the robustness of the existing grid to accept additional or potential new energy generation sources. So as of now, if you look at what we already have pre-established in the country, we have initiatives such as the large solar scale, and we translate into the feed-in tariff, and the third iteration of the net energy metering, which allows people like you and me placing solar panels on the roof, excess energy if you don't use it. You feed it back to the grid. But the grid itself must be able to be robust enough to accept those additional so-called power generated as such. So that conversation led into some level of readiness, because we were led to be assured that the existing grid, although it has been around for such a long time, it is able to absorb that shift. And furthermore, the concept of hydrogen being included in the so-called national energy mix does not really, it is partially a zero-sum game to a certain extent, where we're looking at hydrogen claiming a certain percentage of the energy mix. So therefore, there will be a winning off period from the pre-existing activities that that generates energy from non-renewable resources. For example, coal. We know for a fact the Tenaga Nasional is committed to be part of this decarbonization agenda. So they have committed in terms of decommissioning some of those less than clean power generation activities. So when that is being phased out, hydrogen is being phased in. So for example, in the way we conduct or determine the techno-economic conclusion of our hydrogen economy impact is we look at multiple scenarios. Will be, for example, 5% into the energy mix, 10%, 20%, 50%, because all of these percentages into the energy mix will translate into potential GDP impact, which will also call for a certain amount of investment, not just from the government, but also from all the parties involved or interested parties would have some high level of stakeholding of interest in terms of moving towards the decarbonization agenda.
What I fear is that this could be a huge roadmap, too huge for us to decipher. Do you think that not just Nano Malaysia, but the stakeholders you're working with has the wherewithal to actually pull this off? This is, as you rightfully pointed out early on in the show, or slightly before that, before we started the camera rolling, it's a technology and economy roadmap. It seems It seems mammoth, don't you think?
Yeah, it is. It's gigantic, mammoth, Titanic, name it what you want. But the fact that we are not doing it alone. I think I probably have not mentioned in the earlier or the opening stages of this our session here. Nano Malaysia leads, but we are equally supported by our friends from other ministries. So it's actually a collaborative effort to ensure that from the get-go, it is not a work in silo. So we have primary help from our partner, the Nanotech Center division from the Ministry of Science and Innovation, as our focal or interface, so-called window to the ministry that funds this this study. But at the same time, we are supported by the Academy of Sciences of Malaysia to provide a balanced approach from at least from the academic sector or from their fellows. But importantly, we have inputs coming from the Malaysian Green Tech and Climate Change Center as such. So the study that we are undertaking here is balanced, and it does not provide or create any form of bias towards one entity or the other. So we have that internal check and balance, and we have help from UTM, UKM, from their so-called internal subject matter experts to provide another form of balance to provide those techno-economic analysis. So having said that, because of the core team is already a collaborative effort to begin with, so we are reaching out to everyone to ensure that there is a decentralization of ownership moving forward. Hence, we recognize again Sarawak, Tenaga, UMW, Petronas, and even some of the smaller companies that we have encountered along the way, those companies who are developing potentially disruptive, game-changing technologies such as producing hydrogen without the need for heavy capex investment. So we're talking about you produce hydrogen on the spot and use it on the spot. We call it on-site hydrogen generation, and you feed it into whatever application that you have in mind. So this is a disruptive mindset that we are looking into incorporating into the roadmap. Hence, comprehensive and inclusivity, the very, very small to the very, very big. So we are balancing this. The heavy investment is undertaken by the big boys and girls, whereas the small investment, disruptive approach, your bioreactor to produce from algae hydrogen using solid-state hydrogen, where you can literally keep your hydrogen in a solid-state form, in a stable form, not dangerous form, literally like just outside your doorstep.
And we're running out of time. I have three more questions, actually, specifically. The first question is the rethinking of the public-private partnership. Do you feel that it needs to be rethought of to custom fit the requirements of this blueprint?
Yes. Part of the blueprint, we have created another component that needs to be included in the PPP approach. Number one, what was designed before, a decade ago, is I'm sure you have heard this one called Triple Helix, right?
Yes, of course.
Actually, here's a fun fact. I was in Stockholm and also Uppsala, and I went to both the Nobel Institute to actually learn about the origins of the Triple Helix. That was fun because it was a collaboration there in Germany as well. So, yeah, but that was like, I don't know, 2013? I don't know. I don't remember. But some time ago, lah.
I think we have evolved into a quadruple helix, where we need to get the society involved in providing the need statement, because any kind of foray into the new roadmap, new area, because number one, it will translate into displacement of jobs, but at the same time, because of this disruptiveness nature of this new economy, it will create new jobs. We call it creative disruption. So therefore, displacement, but they are being recaptured due to process of skilling, reskilling or upskilling. So that is something that needs to be assured so that we get the voices from the NGO society to be involved so that we approach this in a more holistic-centric. We have the people, the planet and profit in mind. balanced approach. So we have evolved away from the triple helix into a quadruple helix. And some say the system is able to accommodate another component, the quintuple helix. I think that element is, of course, the environmental element, which is already incorporated in the people, planet, profit approach as such. So that needs to put in place solidly on the ground to ensure that this time around, when we execute, we implement something, it is real with the end in mind. Because the reason why I'm more confident to speak in along this line, because Nano Malaysia, we have a implementation execution experience as such. So the PPP element there needs to be augmented towards future by design as opposed to future by chance. Because in the past, all the countries around the world, they are guilty of adopting this approach of future by design, where they have a generic initiative and they allow things to happen randomly based on what the private sector wants. So the PPP this time, it has to be a meeting point right in the middle where the ecosystem is co-developed both from the government, both in the private sector. So we have this shared responsibility in a new and fresh approach and putting in place the correct value chain as opposed to just leaving, you just have a single touch point or touch and go. So we're adopting the head-to-toe concept. Yeah. Literally like looking at the supply chain and the value chain, and they need to be synchronized accordingly. So on our part, we call it the venture builder model, building the ecosystem to ensure that disruptive and sustainable innovation can be pushed through successfully to the market while respecting pre-existing initiative undertaken by others.
All right, final question is timeline. And of course, the timeline of execution and timeline of the blueprint. How are we looking at?
Okay, in terms of the conclusion of the blueprint or the roadmap itself, so we are due to complete by November. But in terms of the actual execution of what has been put in place, initially we put in place a three-decade aim to achieve that cost and technological targets as such. But we were challenged by our national authorities to say that 3 decades be too long. But I said, that's what IRENA, the International Renewable Energy, has put in terms of the game plan, 3 decades. So let's do it earlier. Look at a 15-year horizon as opposed to 30-year horizon. So we are looking at readjusting our techno-economic analysis and our modeling to accommodate that, because we realize that we do have certain advantages not enjoyed by other countries around the world. So we are looking at really zooming on that, put that into places of prominence to ensure that we can leverage on those pre-existing, such as our hydrocarbon reserves, our Bakun advantage, some of our innovative technology that allows for this hydrogen economy to really, really proliferate in that given time frame.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rizal. Such a riveting conversation to be had. That was Dr. Rizal Khairi Ahmad, the CEO of Nano Malaysia Berhad. If you missed any part of this interview, just head on to astroawani.com. Look for a notepad over there. Look for Nano Malaysia as well. Until then, thanks very much for watching and goodbye.